the one place where news, opinions, and entertainment are the way you like it. This is Rant EM Radio.
What's up, comic book readers, show watchers, and true believers? Welcome to Volume 2 of the Jessica Jones Roundtable, a What Are You Reading comic book show / Talk Brunch crossover. I'm Rick Dara, and on this panel again joining me is my Talk Brunch co-host, Mr. Details Master Analysis Expert Mick Russellin. What's up, homie?
How's it going, man?
Good, good. Excited to be here. And also with us, we have the host of the What Are You Reading comic book show, the man, the myth, the legend, Surfer. Welcome back to the Purple Room, my friend.
Hello, how are you?
Hey, good to have you back. And also here is the hardest working man on Rant EM Radio, taking time out of his ultra busy schedule for us, a reader, a writer, a pop culture master, the jack of all trades, and a master of many, Jordan Cobb. Jordan, how you doing tonight, buddy?
Doing pretty good. That was just me. That was just me snorting the thing that makes me the hardest working man on Rant.
Nice.
And let me tell you, this is some pure cut 100% spice.
All right, that's the stuff. You got to be careful. They ban wrestlers for that.
That sounds like their fucking problem, not mine.
Mm-hmm. And last but not least, from the extended Talk Brunch family, comic book fan and Jessica Jones watcher, Jen. What's going on, Jen?
Nothing much. Sweet Christmas.
Sweet Christmas, yeah.
No, you need more power. Sweet Christmas.
Yeah, sweet Christmas.
Sweet Christmas.
Get anything out of this show. I want more people saying that because I've tried to involve that in my everyday life, being a little Kate fan. People just look at me weird, like, yeah, okay, well, fuck you too, man.
In this volume, we will be covering episodes 4, 5, and 6 of the Netflix original series Jessica Jones, if we haven't made that obvious enough already. So I know at this point, I think everyone here has seen the entire series, right? Jen, are you up to date with this?
I only have one episode left, so I'm pretty much up to date.
Okay, so you've seen 12. That's good enough. So, all right, great. Great to know. But we won't be going past the episodes that we're covering. So without going too deep into it, can you guys one at a time just give overall impressions of your thoughts on this portion of the story so far? We'll start with whoever wants to go. Hell, we'll start with Mick Wrestling. What are your thoughts?
I'm loving it, man. But I've loved the show since episode one. As I've told you, I've been hooked. And the starting episode that we're going to cover tonight, episode 4, with the whole big revelation of who's been taking the pictures of her and everything, like, that was a huge shocker to me. Because remember, I don't want to spoil anything right away, but I asked you, like, what was that character's role? And you were like, oh, he's nobody. And he turned out to actually be an actual major player in the whole thing. So, like, to see they go from that aspect of where you said he was a nobody to him becoming a somebody and where it goes from then on, it's just, it's cool. I love the show more than I like Daredevil.
Yeah, big revelation. Surfer, what are your thoughts on this?
It's getting more intense, this story. It's slowly getting darker and more grittier than the first three episodes were.
Yeah, I definitely see the same thing. It is going in a cool direction. I like the pacing. Everything happening overall so far.
Yeah, I think that's what I like about it a lot, too. It's not to say that Daredevil was campy, but it's a more serious tone than Daredevil took. At least that's what I'm gathering from it.
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead, Jordan.
I'll say I think 6 is where things really pick up plot-wise and such with this portion of episodes. But 4 and 5 got their moments. Like, I particularly like, one of my favorite highlight moments was the speech Jessica gives to her, like, her client, you know, towards the end of 4, which was also like some weird moment of mental health advice.
The speech / tantrum.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because ain't nobody living there after that.
Yeah, it's like, get up. Yeah, it's like, God damn it, get the fuck over it. And I also like that in episode 5, we got more Tennant, who finally becomes a much more prominent player in the narrative of it all. But 6, like I said, is where things really started to pick up in this portion. right. that we're talking about.
Exactly. I agree with you there. And what about you, Jen? What are your thoughts on 4, 5, and 6?
I'm telling you, that's where it starts to hook you. Because, shoot, I watched the first episode, like, that first day it came out, like, at 8:30 in the morning. And been hooked. And it just keeps getting better and better. It's weird because I've heard people who've watched both Daredevil and Jessica Jones, and they keep telling me that, you know, well, you need to watch Daredevil before you watch Jessica Jones. Well, if you know anything about Daredevil, you know, you can put two and two together by episode 13, from what I've been told. But it's weird because I've had coworkers tell me that they like Daredevil better than Jessica Jones.
Yeah, I've actually heard it swing both ways. Some people like Daredevil better still. Yeah. Some people like Jessica Jones. I even think I saw Jordan post recently and say that he still likes Daredevil better, right?
Well, yeah, but look, I'll say this. There are a couple of ways in which Jessica Jones outshines it. One, I think Kilgrave definitely is the best villain on film or television, period. And at times with some of the deeper focus on what they were exploring, theme-wise and such, like, I've been telling this to people that I've been discussing with, like, I think it's honestly kind of great that Jessica Jones came out at the time that it has with, basically, we're living in, basically, rape culture going on. We are still living in a society that's all too ready to blame the victim right away. And mm-hmm. all this men's rights activist bullshit. Yeah. I feel like, you know, with Kilgrave at point even being like a rightful like indictment on that stupid ass stupid movement. And so I feel like that was definitely worth exploring. But in some regards, I feel like Jessica Jones's storytelling and overall narrative structure wasn't as tight as I thought Daredevil's was. Which kept it going consistent, and I think there were a couple things that kind of veered Jessica Jones off a path. But it's like there's like a half a point separating these. It's like, hey, what do you want tonight? Do you want steak or do you want steak? They're both great. I can't really.
They're kind of two different genres of.
Yeah, this is more film noir. Daredevil is more straightforward crime drama.
Well, I was thinking more one more of a superhero, the other, you know, like I said before, she may have superpowers, but she's not a superhero, so it doesn't.
True.
It doesn't.
She's not busting out the super strength and trying to fly in every scene that you see her, and she's having a more human approach towards the obstacles thrown in her path.
Yeah, she's exactly. A bit more of a broken person.
Mm-hmm. Her powers very rarely play a big role in this. And overall, I think my thoughts on this part of this next arc, I really did like it. One thing that stood out to me, I know it's a very small change, but I do like the psychology of the fact that he makes her take a picture and smile every morning. It's funny mm-hmm. to see her character go through so many shitty situations and then have to like smile for a second and take these awkward pictures and send it to him. It's like she has to comply even though she's not being controlled in a way. He still has a different form of control over her. And I think the most interesting aspect of Kilgrave is when he doesn't use his power. You know, he finds other ways to control people. With the drugs.
Like the hell, David Tennant could just do that himself with his usual charm and charisma.
Yeah, with the drugs, with the threats and stuff. And as far as him being the best villain, I think it's subjective. It depends on what you mean by the best villain. If you mean the most intriguing villain, I agree. As far as the best villain, I think he falls far from. And my reasoning is because he's too petty. Because in a sense, most villains want total rule over the world, total destruction, to bring forth some sort of a holocaust or have an empire built in their vision. He just wanted the approval of Jessica Jones.
Well, sometimes the best motivations aren't taking over the world.
Right, but the amount of lives that he puts at stake compared to a true Marvel villain were minimal at best. The incidents that he had, you know, that he was involved in didn't really do that much. Like, he didn't have much ambition for someone with such power. He aimed low. It was more about what a mental wreck he was. Like, fortunately, a true Marvel villain didn't come across that level of power. And granted, the stuff that he does is entertaining and shocking, but it affects the grand scheme of things on such a small margin, such a small ripple caused by such a tiny pebble in a pond, where it basically becomes, if we don't kill Kilgrave, he'll keep fucking with us.
Now, while my favorite villain is someone that would fit in that way, my favorite villain ever is Doctor Doom. It's like, doesn't matter what company's ever. Kilgrave isn't more about that. let's think about it this way. He's also a great example of what would actually happen should someone get the powers that he does.
He just wants
really,
love.
We think, yeah, taking over the world, that'd be cool, but you know what? I'll just do my own shit. You know, hey, shit, things are going to go easy for me now. And part of that is the great, and there's a great psychological study in that, and how Jessica is the object of his desire, because it's like the first thing that said like no to him. And again, also sometimes a bit of an indictment on how sometimes men feel they're entitled to certain things with women nowadays, or pretty much ever throughout society.
Well, also,
actually, that's a great look at that.
Also, Kilgrave as a villain, like he thinks small and petty. Like some people with power, they think on a grander scale. He doesn't think that way at all. He thinks so small in his dealings that you really wouldn't see him as a threat, except for the power that he does have can be dangerous. But it's kind of hard to explain. But
he's only a threat if he targets you.
Right.
He's only a threat if he targets you.
I'm going to sound like a psychopath, but that's what I like about him, about his whole character. Like, if I had his power, I wouldn't go around doing the things that he did to Jessica Jones, but like, I'd use my power. Like, I'd go to a bank and I'd be like, you want to give me all the money in the safe?
Yeah, see, exactly. We'd be doing that sort of stuff.
I do the small petty things like that.
Yeah, exactly. Because Kilgrave's like, you know, I let Dr. Doom and Dim go off and do all that. Me, I'm going to get some free shit. And I'm going to commit a crime out in public. And I'm going to tell the cops, you're going to go arrest that person. Okay. See, that's the type of shit anyone would really do. Sure, there might be someone that could see this as a way of like, I will now take over the world with my mind controlling powers. But it's like, well, that's only going to have so far a grasp, you know?
Yeah, what I find interesting about Kilgrave is that mentally he's like stuck in like the mind of a child.
Yes.
That's what I find interesting.
Well, yeah.
It's all about, you know, I don't want to say trying to get attention, but, you know, trying to survive and, you know, trying to just see how far it can go.
Yeah, he definitely has mommy issues. I think that's what it really comes down to is the mommy issues.
Yeah, you can tell he's definitely got some parent issues.
Yeah, for sure. Which we find out. We won't cover that this volume, but
we're not going to get that far.
Yeah, that comes into play. Anyway.
But again, that's what I like. It's like he's a bit of a more personal villain. And I mean, again, yeah, whole world domination. So that's, you know, again, that's one aspect of why I like Dr. Doom. But there's also the deep characterization and such. And that to me is like there's a. You know, if there's an interesting character beneath all this evil visage, and with characters like Doom and Kingpin from Daredevil, and here Kilgrave, that's what makes him great villains. That's what makes him compelling.
Yeah, he has more of the characteristics of a horror story villain, like almost like a Jason or Freddy in the sense that
which
he's,
works
yeah,
with the psychological thriller aspect.
Exactly.
Of Jessica Jones.
Yeah, because he's affecting a small circle of people, but he's affecting them drastically.
Yes, and also scarier than the Jason Voorhees, for example, because he hasn't been you know, Jason's been rented aground so many times thanks to terrible sequels.
Mm-hmm. So, some Easter eggs that I wanted to just run over real quick before we start. We really talked about a few of those earlier, but Sweet Christmas, you know, the whole that's a Luke Cage thing. It's in there a lot. No, it's great.
Sorry, I got excited when Luke Cage said, I was like, he said the thing. I'm happy.
Mm-hmm. And then we have the entire Danny Rand thing, because I believe, doesn't Hogarth work for the Rand?
Hogarth from the comics is a male who is the attorney to the Rand family and works for the Rand Corporation. He is the one who helps to look after Danny after Danny's parents perish in the incident in the Himalaya Mountains.
Mm-hmm. And then we have Malcolm Paller, who's the assistant. McWrestling mentioned him earlier. In the comic books, he's the assistant to Jessica Jones.
Mm-hmm.
That he is.
At one point, there's a mention of Ozzie Clements. Anyone know who that is?
I was about to say, I didn't read the book. You got to point that one out for me.
I know who that is. My mind just went totally blank.
That's a detective from the Punisher series.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Who played by, I should know, because I was about to say, he also plays my favorite TV cop ever, Lester Freeman, from The Wire. Clark Peters. God damn it. Clark Peters. That was it.
Very cool. And at one point, Jessica recommends another PI. I believe that's in episode 4 that we're going to be getting into. And the PI she recommends is Angela Del Toro, which is the fourth White Tiger. We have also Will Simpson, a.k.a. in the comic book, Frank Simpson, becomes Nuke. So this is Will Simpson. This is not Frank Simpson, but clearly there's a possibility of this going in the same direction.
I'm not going to say much about that, but...
Yeah. I don't think everyone's expecting...
Let's see if this is the tattoo shop. Then, yeah, totally.
Yeah.
They're not going to do that.
I know it's not going to happen, but it'd be awesome.
Well, the one Easter egg that they gave us was that instead of a tattoo, it was Will's lighter that had that.
That
was cool. Just to explain for those real quick, Nuke is a villain in the comics who debuted during Frank Miller's run Daredevil, you know, when Frank Miller was good, and we can respect that. And he is a bit of a failure from the super soldier program and is so American that he has a tattoo on his face of the American flag.
Yeah.
Where's your dedication of that, Trump?
That's not creepy at all.
Bring it.
How did we go there? How in the world did we go there? That is ridiculous.
Getting the name out there, however, you got to do it, man. Trump's going to address this on his next little speech.
Yeah, I'm calling you out. You want to make America great again? Do that.
Yeah, bring it, Los Pelos. Bring it.
And you know what? He just might respond, man. You got to be careful when you say these kind of things. You know, he just might show up on here. I would care.
I'm a slightly unemployed writer who's making no money right now. What the fuck's he going to do to me?
Fair enough. All right. Well, anyway, I guess we'll tour through these episodes a little bit, just discuss scene for scene a few of the cool things that happen. You guys feel free to jump in whenever you want. So this opens basically with Jessica looking at the subway exit for the person that's photographing her. And she's looking all over the city through various angles, and she's thinking about how all it takes is Kilgrave, one suggestion, and they lose control of themselves. She realizes that there's no photo of Luke, so he should be safe. And then we go to a scene of Audrey Eastman, who's at Jessica's door about a case. And she says that she was referred to by Audrey's divorce lawyer, Desmond Tobey from Hogarth, Chowan Benowitz. You know, for some reason when I hear that name, I think of Wolfram and Hart. It just sounds like one of those kind of names.
Yeah, I was going to say that too.
Props on the angel reference.
So Jessica's at this point is overwhelmed with paranoia that everyone she's encountered is somehow linked to Kilgrave, justifiably so. And in the meantime, while she's trying to get over this paranoia, Audrey's telling her about her husband, Carlo, who's supposedly having an affair, and Audrey's suspicious of him. And she wants pictures of Carlo and his mistress in the act. And Jessica offers her a standard contract with the 50% up front. And she asks her, though, she's a little bit paranoid if she's been around a British guy and everything, and Audrey doesn't know what she's talking about. Jessica's not completely convinced, though, but she still takes the contract because I guess she's assuming she can just deal with it anyway. And that's the only way she'll really find out what Kilgrave is up to. So she, in her mind, she's playing along with this person who is clearly controlled by Kilgrave from her perspective. At that point, Jessica gets a call from Trish, who hears that someone's breaking in, and it's the cop from last time, which we know is Will, and she thinks Kilgrave sent him. But then it turns out that he's not trying to bust in because of the fact that he's Kilgrave, but he's doing it because he thinks that he killed Trish, and he's trying to use a ram. He's with, like, another black cop, and
he showed up at the backup, and he's like, there's a body. He's like, are you sure there's a body in there? And he was like, yeah, just go get the ram.
Yeah, he was really, he's a little intense. Yeah. Right?
And then there's that other one where she's like, I'm alive.
Yeah, she just comes out there and she has her neck concealed with a scarf, and they tell both of the officers that everything's fine. And Will isn't buying it at this point. Then they wind up sending the other officer downstairs, and Trish and Jessica tell Will that he can stay.
That was one of my favorite scenes, and he goes, I'm a fan. Yeah. And he goes, it's Patsy.
Yeah.
What I like about that is that it's another great way of showing the effect that Kilgrave has on who he controls, and just how deeply that affects them. It's a really wonderful way of doing that.
But Will's not buying it, so he goes inside, and then Jessica shows her neck, and, you know, they wind up explaining everything to him. Jessica takes him downstairs, and she explains that the only reason he thought he killed Trish is because of the fentanyl injection that Jessica gave him during the struggle. And then Jessica talks to Will, letting him know to stay out of it and that she's going to handle Kilgrave herself. And then he tries to convince her that he'll be useful with his 8 years in the special ops. Because, you know, he's a soldier. He keeps reminding us every fucking scene that he's a soldier and that he's experienced.
Like, bro, we get it. We get it. God.
Disaster waiting to happen.
Yeah, I thought he was a little intense. It's funny because I thought he was.
He keeps time bomb.
Yeah, no pun intended, right? So, anyway, Trish goes on to her radio show to apologize for what she said previously about Kilgrave. And then Jessica explains to Trish that even though she doesn't like doing this, that this is for the best. So she says that, you know, she was wrong to underestimate this guy's power and a bunch of other fluff crap. And then when they leave the building, she gets paranoid, about a random guy that's like taking pictures from down the street. And Trish notices, and Jessica explains the entire thing that's going on with her being watched and photographed. But that person was just a tourist. I mean, they're in the city. You know how that is.
Mm-hmm. Hello, Times Square. Click.
Yeah, exactly. So Jessica deletes all of her files on Luke Cage because she tells herself that despite them being done with the best of intentions, she doesn't need reminders of what she did to Luke. And then Jessica afterwards goes to Holgarth's office to find out that Audrey Eastman was referred to her, and Holgarth tells Jessica that she needs to calm down because she's coming off extremely paranoid, and Jessica gives the most priceless response ever. She says, "Everyone keeps saying that. It's like a conspiracy," and she storms out.
Which I think at about 3:30 a.m. in the morning watching that episode, I was like, this is funnier than it should. That line's funnier than it should be, but fuck it.
So Jessica's tailing Audrey all day to make sure that she's a legit client. At one point, Jessica's between two alleyways with her feet propped up against one wall and her back propped up against another.
Spider-Man style.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was probably somewhat of an Easter egg there. You don't really see anyone who's not a superhero do shit like that. So I thought that was cool. And she explains to Trish over the phone that, you know, his power has like a 10 to 12 hour time limit. So she plans to follow this person until it wears off and then see if she's been Kilgrave, because assuming that she's under control, he's going to have to come and give her basically a reboot at some point. And that's what Jessica's waiting for.
Right.
And then she also takes that opportunity between the alleyways to talk to Will and tell him about the whole Kilgrave following thing, to which Will responds, "I got your six." And he's going to go and do some, bring some surveillance filming and shit. Or whatever.
Oh,
he's
man.
All armed up.
You remember, I don't know if I ever had this conversation with you about how I complained when they brought The Rock into the Fast and Furious series and I didn't like him because he felt, to me, it felt like he was being like an intense G.I. Joe type character. That's how I felt about Simpson.
Well, I've heard even some retired military folk that I use say that sort of thing even out of it. You know, it's like, hey, I got your sex, you know, went back from somebody else.
I know that's like their regular lingo,
but he's pumped.
It's just the intensity of it.
He is pumped. You know
like,
what it is?
Like,
oh, yeah, the intensity's like a little bit like, dude, tone. Might want to tone it down.
They should make it
like,
the sense.
Like, this dude will be in the office and you'll be like, hey, you want to go get some coffee? And be like, Tango, Whiskey, Echo, Delta.
No. That's a code. He says black, two sugars, no creamer.
Good. Good for him. It's too much with that character. You know what they should do? Since Steve Rogers is from New York, he's from New York, right? They should make
Brooklyn-born.
Yeah, they should make Will from New Jersey. You know, because that's... Guess what he is? He's the New Jersey Captain America.
Retcon Marvel Comics.
I'm New Jersey Marvel Captain America, bro. I'm Captain Jersey.
Oh god, that's what his intensity reminds me of. It reminds me of Punisher during the Civil War when Punisher meets Captain America in the sewers.
Yeah, it's too much.
Yeah,
a little too
much.
That
was one of the few good moments of that book.
Yeah, it really is.
Well, than me anyway.
All right. Well, meanwhile, Jerry Hogarth is going out to have lunch with her secretary, Pam, aka her lesbian lover that she left her wife for. And then she runs.
Say lover.
Yeah. Whatever.
Clear,
you know, we're recapping.
It's 2015, man.
Yeah. She runs into her ex-wife leaving and she reveals that this is where Jerry proposed. And Jerry says that she's never going back to her no matter what. And it ultimately ruins lunch for everyone, to make a long story short. No one's eating there.
No one's getting laid after that.
Nah.
Pretty much. But she wasn't going to get laid regardless anyway, because the girl was making her hold out.
No one's eating out. Literally.
I love this guy's Joker laughs.
It's my natural laugh.
It makes the show. So, Jessica follows Audrey into an abandoned warehouse that Audrey is using. And this is where it got weird for me, man, because I didn't see this shit coming at all. You know, we're wondering what Audrey's going to be doing. And she fires her into an abandoned warehouse that she's using as a fucking firing range. But this chick is serious. Like, she has her gun aimed and, like, she's shooting at shit and blasting it. And Jessica comes in through the back door and she's focused. She looks like she's going to kill her husband. And yes, this is the song that was on in the background.
I was like, is that you playing
the music? Yeah, Always On by Death From Above.
My phone's off right now. What the hell?
Yeah, it's a 1979 rock song. And she has this shit on. She's jamming to this while she's shooting, like target dummies. So Jessica's looking, and at this point, I think we, the listeners, are thinking, oh, shit, you know, she's basically going to kill her husband.
Kill him, right.
Like, fuck.
She's going to fuck him up.
Exactly.
But it also ends Jessica's paranoia, because at this part, it's like, okay, she's not being Kilgrave. She's legit an angry wife.
She's an angry wife, you know? There's a part in the lyrics where it says, you know, something about all I wanted was love or something like that. I was thinking, yeah, at this point, they sold me. They sold me on their bullshit story.
You super overanalyze this, man.
Yeah, but you know what? They did it on purpose.
Damn it. I know I've been looking into some shit before, but holy hell!
Yeah, so I figured right at this point, Audrey's in the clear, because all Audrey wants is to be loved. You know, and then they bought me. You know, I'm not gonna lie. They tricked me hook, line, and sinker with this, because just like Jessica, she fell off the radar for me. But at least we got to one of Jessica Jones's iconic lock-breaking scenes to get into the place. Because let's not forget, we have a fetish for those, right? Right?
Yeah.
Take a shot every time Jessica breaks a lock.
Yeah, I could dig that, yeah. And this time she rips the chain and the lock, so you have to take
a
shot.
No, don't do that. You'll be shit-faced halfway through the show.
Yeah, that's very true. But she quietly leaves without notifying Audrey of her presence after that. And then we get back to Hogarth, who basically at this point calls for Jessica, and Jessica says she does not like to be summoned. And she comes into a waiting room filled with people claiming to be mind controlled by Kilgrave.
And I really liked this. This was a very interesting thing that plays out for the rest of the season, because it's a very interesting setup to think, like, yeah, Kilgrave is someone who will use people as much as he can, and other people are going to feel affected by that. And this was a great idea to show how far and wide and, you know...
And they were able to use that scene to lighten the mood a bit.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, because you got the obviously in denial. Mulder's like, Kilgrave made my daughter pregnant. I was like, bitch.
Yeah, no, we're going to literally go in order with these guys, because they were all interesting characters. But just to explain to anyone that hasn't fully watched or didn't comprehend what was going on there, due to the Trish Talk segment, people are trying to get their 15 seconds of fame. So now we have a mixture of people who are actually touched by Kilgrave, as well as people who are just full of shit and using this as an excuse. And in the meantime, the backstory to this is that while Jessica's trying to focus on this, Wendy's making Jerry Holgarth's divorce difficult. Wendy's Jerry's wife, so she's trying to make the divorce. And being that Jessica owes her a favor, she's calling that in during all of this happening. And Jones agrees, but she says later, because she first wants to start interviewing all of these people that are claiming to be Kilgraved. And then the first guy, there's a few guys here. So the first guy is an obvious stoner. And he said that he went to get Doritos from the store when he encountered Kilgrave, who was a Chinese dude with red glowing eyes and a red T-shirt. And he didn't talk, but he just looked at him in the eyes, and he told him that he wants to jack this store. And then he wants to rob the store, and made him pull out his gun. So this is a guy who's trying to get away with robbery, literally. So he's definitely not one of them. And then the second person was a mother that claimed that her daughter Lucy was a nice girl and a virgin. And then she brings in this pregnant teenage girl, and she says that Kilgrave made her do it, and that he's their gardener, and that the gardener told her that all he had to do was tell her that she wanted him bad, and then suddenly she did want him bad. And then the mom says that it's not just Lucy, that it's all of the girls in the neighborhood, and that when he speaks, they spread their legs. And then the daughter describes Kilgrave as never wearing a shirt.
Because he's hot.
Because he's hot, yeah. So that's number two. Yeah, number two eliminated. That's not a Kilgrave. And then the third guy said that he landed.
Man, I'll say that kid, man, that gardener knows how to use a hoe.
Yo.
I regret nothing.
So the third guy said that he landed on Jones Beach and that he thought it was a meteor, but then out came a man from the waves and then he gave him a purple staff and made him slide it up his ass. Not a Kilgrave.
Hot.
Definitely not a Kilgrave.
Still hot.
So then the fourth woman said that Kilgrave lived with her for 2 days and he made her play her cello for him until she made a mistake. And she described him as having dark hair and intense eyes and her fingers were all fucked up from how much she was playing the cello.
Yeah, it's like, it's about as like, you know, if your fingers start bleeding, you're going to still play.
She was Kilgraved. So we have our first Kilgrave, for sure.
Yeah, first legit.
Yeah, knowing the character, that was like the first book. Believable story that you heard about whether these people actually been around Kilgrave or not,
which is very cool because I didn't know if we were going to actually get any. I was almost expecting the scene to be none of these people were Kilgraved.
It would be, but again, we gotta have some laughs because again, we gotta brighten things to fuck up at some point. But then, you know, it's like, okay, but now we're back into it, and I believe that scene was a great way for the show to have its cake in that case and eat it too.
Mm-hmm. And then the fifth woman said that she couldn't stop smiling and that he wouldn't let her. And she described him as wearing a white dress shirt and a tie. So that's another Kilgrave right there. The sixth guy said Kilgrave has dreads and they just quickly moved along because obviously.
Fuck yeah.
Insta-fail. Insta-fail.
He could have had dreads at one time.
You know? Oh, yeah. I remember Kilgrave's awkward college period.
Yeah.
Awkward Kilgrave when he was a stoner just like the first guy.
He was a drifting stoner. See, trying to find himself.
See, Jordan won't admit that he used to have dreads at one time, so.
If I had dreads at some point, I would find a way to invent time travel, go back and kick my own ass. Fuck that.
The seventh guy said he was bald, so we can rule that guy out.
And that's good, because I'll also say white people have no business wearing dreads.
And then this next guy, I feel he had the most traumatic story of all. He said that he was waiting for the L train when Kilgrave said, "Nice jacket. You want to give it to me, right?" And then the guy said, "Yeah." And like an asshole, his words, like an asshole, I handed it over. And he said that although it's not the same as killing his parents, that it was Xenia. And that Kilgrave owed him $5,000. And then he described him as having a British accent. And as much as we wanted this guy to be douchebag.
He called him a limey bastard. And that's
Yeah.
And as much as we want him to be fake, this asshole was Kilgraved. So there was another one there.
Yeah, his story was probably was one of the funnier ones.
Yeah, it really was. It was like, you came here for a jacket.
Good.
I mean, in the face.
He's like, that was a nice jacket.
I mean, that is just like the face of pure evil to have to give up your expensive jacket like that.
I paid $500 for this.
$5,000, man. $5,000.
$5,000, not $500.
Yeah.
Hey, that's my jacket. Shut the hell up.
So it becomes obvious that 4, 5, and 8 have actually encountered Kilgrave. There's others. We don't know who they are. They don't give us their backstories, but there are others eventually.
Yeah, we get to know them a little bit later.
Yeah, exactly.
With the whole support group. And again, I find that this, again, was a great set. It was a great thing to explore because, again, it shows how far and wide Kilgrave can reach outside of Jessica, what he's capable of, and just can make for some great things later on down the road. And
continues to build to show how big
exactly.
a person he is.
Yeah, exactly. And again, also a great way for the show to lighten up for a moment before it's like, okay, now we gotta get back to serious shit.
Yeah,
right. Because there is a big serious aspect to all of this at the end.
Yes, there is. So those guys are put along with a few other ones in the conference room because these are the people who've definitely been Kilgraved. And then Jessica explains to Hogarth that she's using these people to find out what Kilgrave is doing next. And Hogarth implies that if Kilgrave were on their side, he could solve so many problems with his gift. And that makes Jessica sort of rage out. And it's the first hint that we get that Hogarth can just as easily be a kingpin or a Lex Luthor in this as she could be an ally to Jessica.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Foreshadowing?
Yeah. And even if it's foreshadowing, it's good foreshadowing because of the fact that I like Hogarth. Like, she is definitely not, if she turns out to be a villain, she's not your typical black and white type of villain in the sense that she really did genuinely care for.
What I love about that is how Carrie Ann Moss really plays it. It's exceptional because, again, Hogarth is more straightforward good in the comics. Because, again, it's like, I got, you know, I got to raise Danny, you know, all that.
Yeah, exactly.
And what I love here is a different complexion with the character, not just in gender change, but how the character, you know, thinks, how they tick and whatnot. And it's fascinating. And again, the whole Hogarth thing, Hogarth's side story is also fascinating in itself. With how compelling that is. And so it's like, hey, everybody's kind of shitty in this situation. So everybody sucks.
So on the way home, Jessica encounters Simpson and he brings her the surveillance footage that she wants of the area. And as they go into her lobby, he suspects Malcolm, who's hanging around, and then Jessica waves him off and tells him, leave Malcolm alone. And Jessica tells Will that he needs to calm down. And well, she refers him to the group of Kilgrave victims that she's put together and tells him to go seek help since he was also Kilgraved. And then Jessica's on her laptop looking through the security footage, reflecting on how she knows how it feels to be on the other side now, looking in, now that she's being the one stalked. And she encounters the next morning a little girl outside that calls out to her. And when she approaches the little girl, the girl tells her that Patsy Walker is safe and that she doesn't have to worry about her for now. And when Jessica asks the little girl who told her that, she says the man. And then she says that Kilgrave liked her apology. And Jessica asks how old she is and then tells the little girl that she's sorry that all of this is happening to her. And then the little girl responds with, you're a bitch. And says, you could have stopped the bus, but you left him there to die like some goddamn dog in the street.
I don't know, when I see little kids like curse on television shows, it's just like, oh my god.
I see little kids like that in real life.
That's how little kids usually are.
A bitch.
I guess.
Yeah, and then she basically says, you know, you let him die like a goddamn dog in the street and everything you touch turns to shit. And
well, what I also like about that is how it also does some nice characterization of Kilgrave, because I is like, man, you are such a petty fucking person. That again, you know, I know it was shown last episode with how he sent those guys after Trish, you know, after Trish, but it really shows as like, you petty fucking child. You're so easily, even
children aren't safe.
Yeah, it's like your ego's this so easily bruised that you're, man, not just in using the child, but just in the message that he had the child give says so much about Kilgrave.
Yeah,
that's what I was meaning. Also, another great way, you know, to get under our skin more is how Kilgrave will use anybody, age, sex, it don't matter, anybody. If he's going to use that old lady in the bodega down the street, he'll use her.
Yeah, I agree. He's definitely, he's wild. You know?
He's very selfish. I mean, it's the extreme measure, the lengths he'll go to just to please himself. And it can be frightening and it can be terrifying in the right situation.
Yeah, definitely. So then the little girl tells her that it's Friday and asks her if she has a job to do, which reminds Jessica of her commitment to Audrey. And she asks the little girl where Audrey is and if Kilgrave did something, and the little girl starts to freak out, and then the mom comes running and tells Jessica to get away and leave her alone.
Yeah, good parenting on the mom part to let the daughter just wander off like that for a good 5 minutes.
And not realize she was gone until she started screaming.
That happens, what, every 2 minutes?
One can assume that Kilgrave must have said something to the mom to send her in one direction, then something to the daughter in the other, you know, very easily. You want to leave her here.
Could have told her to stay put and then have the little girl walk off.
Yeah.
And then possibly be nearby to kind of break and be like, go after your daughter. You know, and point her to the way it's like, yo, hey, that, hey, so white, hey, yeah, hey, white woman taking your girl.
We're going to get in so much trouble for this episode.
Why is it going to be erased? There is no trouble. There's no such thing.
Jessica.
So
this is the third abused child in this series so far.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. From the first family that he goes to, and he puts the two kids in the closet.
And we never found out if they ever got out of the closet or not. I mean, we know the little girl went in there and
Kilgrave's effects wear off after 12 hours. So after Jessica laid out the whole family, assuming the kids get out.
He was in there for a while. And I'm quite sure he kept those kids in the closet like the whole time.
It makes you feel better. The kids are happy and safe and eating ice cream.
They're gonna have Christmas dinner.
He had them in there like for days.
Maybe, but in my version, they got out.
Yeah, that's what I said. I'm gonna just chalk it up to like he wasn't there that long, and then once the effects wore off, then
we don't know if he was being fed in there. You know?
Okay. There's a lot we can go into with that.
Yeah. Surfer definitely is the guy who keeps up with our death count because he was the one who asked what happened to the other Alexandrians that we don't know that were off camera. Anytime somebody dies off camera, Surfer catches that shit. It's like, aha, what happened to those characters? Well, they died off camera. Maybe that's it. That's what you want me to say, Surfer? The little girl died in the closet?
No, because now he's going to have nightmares tonight.
Okay. Spoilers. Everybody's dead.
In the closet.
Yes.
The little brother ate the sister or something.
They're all dead. It's going to be like that Game of Thrones joke that everyone says, spoiler alert, and then they were all mermen. Like, that's how they say the whole series will end.
They're all dead.
They're all dead. Children
made them kill each other.
That's a legit tinfoil theory, by the way, folks, that they all turn out to be mermen.
I'm just saying, no kids have been harmed in any other Marvel property.
Jesus, there's a...
Until now, so...
All right, so Jessica's like, oh, shit, I do got a job.
Anyway, so next we have Will, who's back at Trish's intercom, and he claims that he wants to make it up to her and that he has something for her, something personal, and she tells him to put it on the floor and move away from the door. And when she gets the box, it's a gun for her. And Will tells her that he wants her to feel safe, and then she asks if it's legal, and of course he says no. We get back to Jessica, who's spying on Audrey's husband, Carlo, and she's following him, and she uses her super jump for the first time to get up to the second floor that Carlo's in, and she watches him go into one of the apartments. And then she peeks at Carlo, who's in bed with a woman. And while she's right outside the door, she gets a call from Audrey. And it's just one of those awkward can you hear me now moments, because it turns out that Audrey is the one in the room with Carlo. And Jessica comes into the room and Audrey pulls out a gun on her. And this is one of the few times where I had no idea what the fuck was going on right away, where it was like, did I miss a scene?
Because it was like she wasn't Kilgrave. Like she wasn't a suspect. And then it was like, so what's really going on here right now?
Yeah, and then we get into her backstory, which is during the incident. New York, her mother was killed. Her mother was killed. And now she's like, I'm going to take it out on all you motherfuckers.
Mm-hmm, during the Avengers big battle. And at this point, we get a comic book Easter egg because Jessica Jones pretending to be bulletproof is straight out of the graphic novels.
No, it is. It is. And it's at this moment, that's one of my absolute favorite moments in the series where she just goes off on Audrey and gets some tough love where she's bitching at them, but also giving like some mental health advice, like, take your goddamn pain you live with it, assholes.
Yeah, pretty much, right?
It was a great moment for Kristen Ritter to really stand out.
Yeah, pretty much. She doesn't, she shoots her, but, you know, Carlo basically, in the meantime, he's trying to talk Audrey out of this, and she wants to know how many gifted people there are like Jessica, and then she, the whole Avengers 1 thing comes into play. But, you know, Jessica, doesn't she say something like blame it on the flag waver and the green guy?
The flag waver and the green guy.
Which I thought, whatever, that's cute.
Yeah, and then Jessica gets out of the gunpoint thing by pulling out the plastic that's on the ground from underneath them, which, why did they want her to stand on the plastic? Does anybody understand what that was about?
I guess they figure when they kill her, it's easier to clean up the blood on the plastic.
Oh, wow. So they're tidy people. They're tidy murderers.
Yeah, they watch Dexter.
Yeah, because I was thinking, it threw me off because I was thinking, what do they think? That her weakness is fucking plastic? You know, get her on the plastic.
It's easier for them to kill her and then just like drag the body out with the plastic.
Again, they've seen Dexter. They've learned shit.
Yeah, oh. or American Psycho.
Or yeah. Two Girls, One
yeah.
Cup.
Yeah! No! God. see, we were having fun, man, and then you gotta bring Ashton up.
Yeah, but then Jessica fucks the whole apartment up, and she says that she's lost her parents in a car accident, but that you don't see her trying to kill everyone and every shitty driver because she doesn't work her shit on other people. I mean, she picks up like a fucking radiator and throws it through a wall. And this goes back to what I talked about in Volume 1, where it's like she has inconsistent strength. Because you think that if a woman who could throw a radiator through a wall, no one's kicking her ass. You know what I mean? She literally was like hulking out at this point. And then, Jessica, we get the reference of the name of the episode because Jessica tells Audrey that she has 99 gifted friends in this borough alone and that she's going to tell them all about this. And then she says the only thing that they could do to save themselves is to disappear and never be heard from again. And then Carlos says that he wants a divorce.
Yeah. It was so fucking good. And again, you don't see me, going after every bad driver. It was again, you take your pain, you take your goddamn pain, you live with it.
Yeah, exactly. That's what you gotta do.
Now, I want to backtrack to Trish's situation.
Okay,
she's not being the brightest bub in the house because she's paranoid. She got all this security and triple thick doors and everything, and yet for some reason, because Will shows up the first time, she gives in and opens the door for him, and then opens the door for him again. And then sits there and has these long conversations with him through the intercom.
Well, you get to know a lot about a person when you're sitting outside their door.
Yeah, it's more of like they sat there for hours and he explained the person that he is, and she knows Jessica's situation, so she understands that what he did wasn't the person that he was, which he tells her those exact things, like that wasn't me.
Yeah,
and they started to connect, and it could be worse. He could be standing outside her door, holding up a boombox that's blasting Peter Gabriel.
Yeah, exactly. Oh my God, I can't believe you went there. But anyway,
this is slightly better than that, and actually more meaningful.
All right,
he tells her the little story about with the Barbies and the fire and the G.I. Joes and stuff.
That's a sweet moment. That's a nice character building moment.
Yeah, it was. You know, and he says that he's always been the guy trying to save people, and the guy who tries to that tried to kill her wasn't him. And she says that she doesn't blame him, and then that's when she lets him in, and she says that she might shoot him by accident, but he says that it's worth the risk because Will's about to get some pussy. So
she let him in, all right.
Yeah, but yeah, she let him in. You see? I like that. Before we even got to that scene, though, Jessica was in the shower, and the bullet that wound had already looked like it was a scratch, which was just confirming that she's a very fast healer, something that we did not know up to this point about her in the Netflix canon. And after she gets out of the shower, she goes over the tapes of Kilgrave and the victims. But just back to the Trish thing, they wind up bonding over coffee after she lets him into the place. And it looks nice, you know. It's nice that they were able to mend the fences, I guess.
That was a Grand Theft Auto Easter egg. She invited him in for some hot coffee.
Some hot coffee. We're not getting out of this, are we? Hogarth calls Jessica and tells her to tend to Kilgrave's support group. She stops into the diner, and all the survivors are there listening to the stories of each other about the Kilgrave stuff that happened. And then this one guy tells a story about how he was Kilgrave's chauffeur for a week. He was driving him around and shit. And she immediately starts probing this guy, and he tells her that he had to drive Kilgrave to meet the same guy every day at 10 a.m. on the dot, and that all he knows is that the guy wears a blue and white striped scarf. So this causes Jessica to rush home to check her surveillance that she received from Will Simpson on her laptop. And then she finds out that it is Malcolm, and she goes into his apartment, and she finds the pictures in the printer of her, confirming that it's him, and she sheds a single tear for Malcolm, and then the episode ends.
And it's a great ender right there, because it's a crushing blow for Jessica, meaning, wow, she really isn't going to be able to trust anybody at this
time. And then
he was in her face the whole time.
And it hits her all at once.
The only person she can rely on is really Trish, and, well, sadly right now, Hogarth, who really isn't the best sort of option of a person to use her trust. But really, that's all she has.
Yeah, and it hits her when she sees Malcolm's mother, a picture of him and his mother. It makes her realize that this person that she's been looking at and pitying is probably this way because of her situation. And I think that's really what hurt her there the most.
Absolutely.
So then we move on to episode 5, a.k.a. The Sandwich Saved Me. And it starts with a flashback 18 months earlier, where we see Jessica bored at an office job making rubber band balls, and her boss is being a total dick to her, and she calls him on his bullshit and prints out missing funds and a non-existent employee that he's paying, and points out his weekly trips to Atlantic City and the fact that he wouldn't be able to afford all of this on his salary, and tells him that he's a felon, basically. And then she says that she wants 6 months severance pay and a glowing recommendation, or she emails the information to human resources. And he says, your parents would be so proud, which was a trigger for her because she pushes over a roll of filing cabinets and leaves.
Yeah, and it's great because now we get to see pre-Kilgrave.
Something we've all wanted to do at one time.
Yeah, we get to see Jewel. Yay!
Yeah! Yes, Jewel, which is a nice little Easter egg, as that is her superhero name. We even get to see the costume.
Yeah, I'm marking out.
And how
out.
Ridiculous that would actually look in live action.
I am marking out. So, Trish and Jones have lunch, and they talk about her job luck, and it's a funny scene where, like, this guy comes up to them, and he's singing.
This is, like, my favorite scene in the
episode.
Love,
you love when people sing Patsy at her. You seem to love it almost as much as she hates it. But, yeah, this guy comes out.
Because her doing, because that dude singing it, like, got him in trouble.
Yeah, he was all like, it's Patsy. And he said that he learned a lot from Patsy, including how to juggle a remote and I don't even remember what the penis reference was he made. But basically he's saying,
masturbation.
Yeah, Patsy taught him how to jack off, you know. And he wants Trish.
Patsy shuttle? I can make it louder.
He wants Trish to play a game of love tester with him, and Jones accepts instead, but she doesn't want to play the love test. She wants to play the strength test. And she says that if she wins, he picks up the bar tab, apologizes to Trish, and, you know, all of that shit. And if not, what happens? She basically takes him out back and she meets his penis. I'm not using any metaphors here. So the guy punches the machine and he gets like a 523, and then Jones goes after him and gets a 999, which I guess is cool. I wanted her to break it like Vegeta did.
Yeah, that's exactly what I thought was going to happen. I thought she was going to, like, set up to do the punch and, like, flick it with her pinky.
Yeah, I love when Vegeta just took that shit out. It was like, boom, and it went completely apart.
Man, what could I get from that?
No, Trunks was the one that hit it with his pinky, right?
Jordan, you heard Jordan, he's like, what could you get for 999? You could get screwed. What? You could get screwed for $9.99 is what you can get.
Or you could get the t-shirt and get screwed.
Yeah, you could get double screwed.
Or I could just go buy a cherry phosphate. But
I think she hit it harder than that, but, you know, the machine was up so high.
And what I'm liking about this, and I got a bit of a slight criticism of this, because seeing flashback just goes like, there's not much of a change of personality here, except that we get to explore how there is a bit more of a change.
There was a huge personality change.
Yeah,
her expressions.
Yeah, down in the episode. I mean, like in the whole sardonic, sarcastic, like, you know.
Right. Well, that was just, she was always a spirited person, but her face, her facial expression, she didn't look as broken. She seemed happier.
No, she wasn't as broken. She actually still had a healthy, you know, outlook on life, mainly thanks to her friendship with Trish, which is the Jessica Trish relationship is one of the most consistent things throughout this entire series, and that it's an incredible friendship.
Mm-hmm. It really is.
This was basically Jessica Jones's sort of Nelson v. Murdoch, you know, exploring it through flashbacks the importance of this relationship between these two characters.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so again, Jessica was a bit of, again, it is showing how Jessica was a much happier person before everything went to shit.
Yeah.
And again, that's the change that it does so much better as it goes along. Because again, at first thing, I was like, well, personality wise, I could just still see her, you know, kind of being like this. But, you know, the more you get to explore what was going on with her life at that time, the more you feel like, oh, then, yeah, it was a completely different outlook on life she was having and such. And it was all fine and dandy until this asshole came along
and ruined everything.
Yeah.
So when Yes. So when Jessica hits that 999, the waitress looks over like, what the hell? And then Trish says she did the 30-day shred. Julian Michaels changed her life. And like the waitress is just still looking at them like, what the fuck's going on? You know, and Trish shares her desire, which is one of the cool things I like about the character Trish. Trish is the one who wants to be a fucking superhero. Trish wants to go out and fight bad guys and save the world and kick ass and have a cool name and stuff, you know? So Trish is sharing these desires with Jessica to become a hero. And then Jessica says, you want to be a hero? Let me show you how. And then she says, shots on Trish Walker, everyone. And everyone in the bar is like, yay! And that ends the flashback. And Trish gets her moment to be a hero. Not quite what she meant, but Jessica did solve the problem, right?
I guess.
So back in the present, Jessica and Trish are looking over photos of Malcolm. And she talks about how in hindsight, Malcolm was an obvious person. And then she trails him later in the day to see where he goes. And he waits in the middle of, you know, what's funny about this. I didn't realize it when I watched it the first time. I watched this a second time. He waits in the middle of what looks to me like Washington Square Park. I go there to eat lunch sometimes, you know?
That's exactly where he was.
That's where it was, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I'm like, wait a minute, there's Washington Square Park. You know, I saw like the bars around the side and stuff when at that point when he's stopping and looking around. And it was just like, oh, cool. So, but anyway, she catches a shot of Kilgrave, and that's when her PTSD kicks in. And she has to do the whole Main Street, Birch Street, Higgins Drive thing. But what I like is that since she's frustrated, she goes Main Street, Birch Street, Higgins Asshole Drive. You know, and she pulls out the safentanil needle, but she doesn't make a move. And Malcolm gives Kilgrave the photos, and he gives Malcolm an envelope that I'm assuming either has money for drugs or whatever. But they make the exchange there. And
I assumed it was the drugs because it looked like a pretty small envelope.
Yeah, I was assuming the drugs, too.
Yeah, maybe. Who knows? He gets something. We know he's getting drugs either way at the end of this. So, Back at Alias Investigations, Jessica and Trish are discussing how Malcolm moved in down the hall 4 months ago, and that Kilgrave must have gotten him hooked on the drugs, and then Jessica notes that Malcolm is a good spy, and that it could have been his alternate career if Kilgrave didn't kill him first, and then Trish tells Jessica that they're going to pull him out of this. The following day, the same scenario takes place. Jessica follows Malcolm back into Washington Square Park. Except that this time, instead of Kilgrave, he sends a messenger. A random woman whispers instructions into Malcolm's ear and then appears to be coming out of a daze. So we realize that she was Kilgraved. And Jessica approaches her and asks her what she told Malcolm. And she says that she told him to go to kiosk in 16th off of Park Avenue because a British guy told her.
The scene kind of bugged me because first she was like, I don't have time for this. And then she goes, what did you tell him? And then she's all compliant with it and gives her the directions. And then she goes back to, I don't got time for this. I got to go.
Yeah, and you know what? Not for nothing. I mean, I guess this is just a New Yorker in me, but even with the Kilgrave power and even with the drugs, if you're at fucking Washington Square Park, which is around 28th Street and 6th Avenue, and somebody tells me to go to kiosk and 16th, I'd be pissed. Be like, what are we doing? Like, come on, you could have just...
I'm not what you call a New Yorker, but I imagine that's a... Oh, fuck that, I'm not walking that far.
Yeah, well, I mean, Park Avenue, you know what I mean? I guess when you're in Manhattan, when you walk around, it doesn't feel like it's as far as it is. But it is. Especially if you need drugs fast. Not kidding.
Okay.
I'm not speaking from first-hand experience. I'm talking about in the perspective of Malcolm. All right, come on.
I do have a serious question to ask. When I do finally visit New York for the first time, where is the best place to get drugs?
Continuing.
I'm asking for a friend.
Jordan, you don't need to go. It'll eat you up and spit you out.
Ooh, I like that. Yeah, so Jessica sees Kilgrave in the distance picking up a bunch of magazines off of a newspaper stand. And it's funny because my legit thoughts at this point was nothing can really go wrong here. I don't know why I was thinking that, but I was thinking the first normal thing I've seen Kilgrave do, you know, he's just getting some magazines. But of course... Typical Kilgrave, the owner tries to stop him, so Kilgrave tells him to pick up his own coffee and throw it in his own face.
Pick up your coffee, toss it in your face.
And the guy's like, ah! And he screams. I wish I had the soundbite of him scream because it sounded like a fucking scream that you would get when you put coffee in somebody's face, didn't it? You know, like I felt like coffee was in my face when that happened, man. Like rough times, really rough times.
I was actually sipping coffee during that scene.
Yeah. Since we don't have that scream, I do know a scream that we do have available.
Oh, God.
That's right. The Wilhelm scream. It fit into the story somewhere, right? Wouldn't that have been great? Like, how cheesy would that have been? But we would have recognized it. Like, if when Kilgrave told him, put the coffee in your face, you would have just suddenly heard that.
or say it for more like Monty Python, like,
oh boy.
Wouldn't it be great? I'd be like, dude, Monty Python reference, best thing Marvel's ever done.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. So, yeah, that was that. Then a whole bunch of people rush to this guy and, you know, they're trying to help him. They don't know what the hell happened. And we wind up doing
I call bullshit on that scene because in this day and age, everybody would have pulled out their cell phone and, like, take selfies and shit.
Yeah, that's true. No one would have went to help that guy, especially over there.
OMG, this dude totes burned his face. Look at the pic I got.
Yeah, but you know what? That part of town's not really that tainted. You know what I mean? Like, if you saw something, you'd probably say something.
Oh, yeah, with a Mayflower filter. Yeah, that's always real nice.
So we do a slight time jump, and Jessica is back in her apartment trying to get back in contact with Trish. And her neighbor, Ruben, from the Twin Cess Squad, comes in to visit.
And we get to my least favorite thing on this goddamn show.
And she gets to eat some banana bread. He asks her if she likes banana bread. She says no, takes it, and eats it behind the door.
I like the little expression on her face where it was like, not bad.
Yeah, like she did like it. And you and see
then,
Ruben.
And then you see him like a creep peeping behind the door.
Yeah,
so.
Like she's eating the banana bread. You know, so
Senpai noticed me.
Yeah. So then he put
some love into that.
Yeah. So then we cut to Trish's.
That
apartment.
Did not sound right, man.
It wasn't supposed to.
Yeah, exactly.
Damn it. I want to scrub my brain after we finished.
So then we cut to Trish's apartment where, she's getting head from Will.
Oh.
She's having a nuclear experience. You know, very sexy times. I like how it shows just her. At first, I thought she was concentrating or meditating or doing some Hellcat type shit. But then it was like, oh no, this has nothing to do with that whatsoever.
The camera pans down. You see a huge lump between her
legs. Yeah, push the
patient. That's what this show's been lacking, some sex.
Yeah, now we're getting it too. Oh, he was under the covers too, you know?
Well, Luke's been out for the last couple of scenes. So.
Yeah. And when you're under the covers like that, man, where he's not even like, no part of him is exposed, all he could see is her pussy under there. So, you know, he was ready. Crazy. Yeah, but yep, that's what basically happened there. And then you know what it's interrupted by? Good old Jessica pounding on the door. And she tells her...
the female equivalent of a cock blocker? Now we'll figure this out. Just keep going.
Yeah, and she says she's pounding, like really pounding. Like what a buzzkill. Like and tells her that if she wants to help Malcolm, that it's time to put on her cape. And you know what? I really feel for Trish in this situation because... when someone pounds on your door like that, you're mad at automatically, no matter what, gonna go into like hyper defense mode, even if it's a friend, because of the pounding. Like, dude, the other day somebody did that. I was just sitting here relaxing and writing, and I heard boom, 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 boom. My own house and shit. And I was like strafing across walls and shit, trying to peek. Like, who is it?
Why spend the door and every other time just jumping through the window?
Yeah, just jumping through the window or break the lock off for an awkward.
Getting that good ahead.
Yeah, you know, do something like that. Exactly.
Like, have you not felt the meltdown just on my genitals? Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah. I mean, scaring people like that. But in my case, it was just a wrong address delivery. But in her case, she's being you know, but in her case, it was Jessica, and she explains the Kilgrave process and the plan to deliver the fentanyl through a long range dart. And that's when Will comes out of the bedroom and he gives his perspective on just taking him out with a pistol. And then she explains that she needs to be kept alive. Well, he needs to be kept alive because of hope. And, you know, that whole little back and forth between the two of them happens where Will wants to help, but Jessica doesn't want him to. And then she reluctantly lets him, thanks to Trish. So they're off to a mission where Jessica and Will are driving, and she tells him that if he's so great, why did they release him from the spec ops? And then Will says that that's classified for season two. Well, he doesn't say season two, but he says classified.
You ain't got no shit.
Yeah, they're foreshadowing all of the nuke shit. And if anyone doesn't want to be spoiled, don't look up the nuke shit then. Very simple. You know?
Or don't get on Facebook.
Yeah. So
walk out Wikipedia.
Yeah, exactly. So they go to that soundproof biosafety vault that they want to keep him in, and then Jessica talks through the glass, and then Will talks shit back to her because the two of them can't hear each other, so they're sort of playing off of that. With Jessica, I find what she says interesting because she says that she can tell that he's just basically some mentally unstable, crazy guy who probably shot up a town or something, which is really what he comes off as.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So we get a flashback of Jessica dressed as a sandwich in the rain. It almost sounds like a song, right? But anyway, she's selling 2-for-1 hoagies, and then a little girl almost gets hit by a cab, and Jessica stops that from happening, and the little girl...
The sandwich saved me.
Yeah, the little girl's father comes on. She says, the sandwich saved me. And we go to a scene of Jessica finding Malcolm in the elevator unconscious.
That's the most humiliating job to have, to be dressed like a sandwich.
But, bitch, if they're paying, I'll do it.
I'd say dressing up as Elmo in Times Square, but yeah, I guess.
If that's paying, I'll do it.
Hey, Elmo's a famous star.
Yeah, that sandwich is a nobody.
Look, look, guys, just tell me where I gotta sign up to get paid for dressing up as something and handing out shit.
You know what would be a worse sandwich-related person to dress up as?
Jared. Please tell me that's where you were going with this.
Of course that's where I was going with this. Where else would I be going? I was going to actually leave it ominous, but you guessed immediately.
Wow, how appropriate.
You know, you just blew any sponsorship from that organization.
Thanks for ruining it, Dick.
Oh, you know what? He blew sponsorship from that organization.
Hey, I'm more of a Quiznos man, but Subway pays big bucks.
I'm more of a Quiznos guy, too. You see, we're going to get Quiznos as our sponsorship.
Okay, I don't mind. Okay, well, I don't mind that, but I don't mind Subway as well because that's what I got here in Nashville. Okay, we're going on a tangent. Anyway,
but you know what? You're right though, because that's why I go with Subway. Subway's closer.
Anyway,
if it wasn't for that, I'd totally go with Quiznos.
So Malcolm's found in the elevator, presumably
unconscious
once again,
and
high
she's with
off his ass.
Yeah, and she tells Ruben that she's taking him home, and I think when she says this, she did not literally mean his apartment. She was basically that was her way of saying to herself that I'm going to save this guy.
I'm bringing him back to reality.
Yeah, but
she had before.
Yeah, so she puts him back in the apartment, and then Trish and Will, we cut to them, which are in a van, and Will wants more info on Jessica, and he's basically being paranoid and probing Trish about this. We wind up transitioning back to Jessica, who puts Malcolm to bed and gets a call from Hope, because Hope wants some money, and Jessica goes to visit Hope in jail, and there's this big butch girl named Sissy who's rushing Hope to get her business done. So at this point, I'm assuming, oh shit, they're shaking Hope for some money. They want to.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
And Jessica hands over some cash. We have another Trish and Jessica flashback. This is, I think, everyone's favorite because we get to see the Jewel outfit. Trish breaks out the Jewel outfit and she's like, why don't you dress like this? We'll call you Jewel. And Jessica doesn't like it because Jewel's a stripper's name. And Jessica says that if she wears that thing, that they're going to have to call her Camel Toe.
Also, because that outfit really would not work in live action.
No, it would not.
Oh, my God. I'm glad we didn't even get to see her in it. It'd be like, that does not translate well.
I
want to say I would have liked to see her in it, but I feel like it would have come off as very tacky and bad.
Yeah, it would have. And I know everyone likes this scene. This is the favorite flashback because of the fact that you get the Jewel Easter egg and you get to see the outfit and everything. And I agree, it's also my favorite, but it's not for those reasons. And it's more for the reason because ultimately I realized that this was the night that one way or another, costume or not, Jessica decided she was going to become a hero. That's the final time that we see her. She's not looking for a job anymore in the flashback. She's not doing shitty jobs. That was it. Even though they didn't agree on the costume, the decision to be a hero was there.
She felt herself as a true hero, Sandwich. And in that was to make up for not being able to do that pun while we're going up on Subway. It was a nice little soft moment that says a lot about the character.
Really good elevator scenes in this episode. I would say that some of the most powerful stuff happens in the elevator because after this, we get a scene with Jessica and Malcolm going down the elevator. And it's funny because this time the only difference is that Jessica's just fucking grilling him. She's just staring at him really hard. And from his perspective, and I think if you don't think about it the first time when you're watching it, you would think, she's thinking this motherfucker's taking pictures of me and for drugs and Kilgrave. But I realized watching it again that I think this was Jessica trying to look through Malcolm and really see him for the first time, not as the druggie or as the junkie. Now that she gets what's going on, she's looking at him.
She's staring at him like, I'm going to make this work. I'm going to bring you back.
Yeah. And that's the reason why when they both exit the elevator, she goes left, he goes right, and she turns around and says, hey, hang in there. And he just says thanks and then walks away because she realized that this was fucked up and that underneath that, there's a person that Kilgrave's like torturing. So
exactly. It's a nice little moment between characters that's really effective.
Yeah. So then we get to Will and Trish in the van and Jessica's trailing Malcolm. And as Will's approaching Kilgrave, once they find the designated location, a balloon pops and it gets Kilgrave's attention. Jessica distracts him, and then Will takes the dart shot and catches him in the neck, and Malcolm runs away. Jessica picks up Kilgrave's body, and they're being trailed by some of his guys, and then they get away with him in the van. And then they pull over nearby, and Trish reminds Jessica that they need him alive. So she punches him really hard in the face and says, "See, he is alive." And then Jessica realizes that he's wearing a tracker. And the moment she realizes this, suddenly the van doors open and they're being attacked by a bunch of guys with tasers. And here comes another one of Jessica's inconsistent superhero powers, because they actually kick her ass. Like, they're tasing her enough. They're saying it's not working, but it is working, because she's on the ground. She's unable to get up. They manage to get Kilgrave and successfully get away. It only took one.
They mean it's not working to the point where if they took one of those tasers, because remember, that's the same type of tasers they used on Goldberg back in WCW.
Because it only took one taser.
Should have been able to drop her and keep her down, but they
literally multiple tasers.
Yeah, it only took one taser to KO Hellcat. You know, but then her, on the other hand, they're all trying to hit her a lot. And even Will was able to take a taser too. But ultimately, they managed to get Kilgrave out of there, which was weird because that was their best shot of having him. I was kind of pissed off.
It was of her strength, because in the bar, she's throwing guys like they're nothing. But here, it's like they're getting the best of her even before they teamed up on her. She was struggling to take these guys on.
Yeah, and it may it's a combination of all those teams trying to take Jessica down, and it made for a bit of a thrilling sequence to get us pumped up towards the end.
Yeah, and then they interrogate the one guard that they did manage to keep, and it turns out to just be a paid guard that didn't really know anything. He just is an anonymous paid guard.
Yeah, he's like, "Hey, he paid us money to make sure you guys didn't come around." Can I go home now?
I was afraid that the reveal who was paying them was going to be somebody. To be honest, I thought it was going to find out Hogarth was paying them to keep Kilgrave safe.
I didn't think of that.
Neither did I, because I thought, what the fuck would that do?
Because that's not helping her in any way. That's keeping Jessica more distracted from what Hogarth would want her to do.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
No, I mean, it's not the case, but I was afraid at that point that's what they was going to find out, that just the law firm was behind paying for these security guards, because they weren't working for Kilgrave. It was just being hired. So
ultimately, they wind up, after they interrogate him, he doesn't really have any information. On the way home, Jessica overhears Malcolm begging some dealer for drugs. And Malcolm gets aggressive with the girl, and the girl pulls out a gun. I've seen her somewhere before. She's an actress from something. You guys know who I'm talking about?
I don't know what I've seen her in.
Who exactly?
She did seem familiar.
There's like when Malcolm's trying to get drugs desperately from some Hispanic chick in his apartment, and she pulls a gun on him because she's like, "I got a better TV than that at home with the HD and everything." Her, like, I feel like I've seen her in something else. But anyway.
She's more like a blank face now.
Yeah, but...
To me.
But anyway, Jessica disarms her, and the girl retreats, and then Malcolm tells Jessica that she can't save him again. And then that leads into the Malcolm origin flashback, where we find that Malcolm was being mugged. And when the muggers realized that Malcolm saw their faces, they were about to kill him. And then out comes Jessica doing her superhero thing. And she beats the guys off of Malcolm. And then that's when Kilgrave gets her, and he's like, "Hey, you know, that was amazing what you did there."
And Hey, hold one, hold two, fuck on.
Yeah, and it's just funny the fact that he tells her, you know, "Why are you doing that?" And she's like, "Because I made a difference." And he, like, wants to gag. He's like, "Oh," you know, like, he's just such a scumbag.
Yeah, sure. But he's also a bit amused by that.
Yeah, he was amused.
Yeah, he's just like, "That's fascinating."
Mm-hmm. And thanks to that, she winds up eating Chinese food and having sex with him. Wonderful. What was that? Was that Kilgrave Zipper?
And then... Yeah, non-consent. We should add non-consensually.
Non-consensual.
And then there's that great scene at the end where, you know, Kilgrave regains consciousness and realizes what happened and calls up Jessica and basically plays a bit of a mind fuck with her.
Yeah, he did realize he dodged a bullet there, because she could have easily just ended him.
Yeah, but, yeah. But first we get Jessica, who has Malcolm tied to a toilet and is trying to detox the guy. And she says how, she basically goes into his backstory of how he was going to be a social worker. And then Malcolm explains that it wasn't just the control, that he did have a choice. And he reminds her that, you know, he went to see Kilgrave only at 10 in the morning, and that the control doesn't last long enough. Within that time, he would have already broken free. So he partially did it for the drugs. And then Jones tells him that if he lets himself be like this, that Kilgrave gets to her, because he's doing this to torment her, to make her feel like an infection, just one more person dead or dying because of her. And she asks Malcolm to save her for once. And she leaves him some drugs and a needle and tells him to choose, which I thought was very admirable, because, you know, in the real world, he would have went straight for those drugs. But he's a character, so. We get a quick flash to Sissy, who wakes up Hope in prison with a beating. We still don't know what's going on there, but it's like, all right, she's getting her ass whipped. Fair enough. And then Kilgrave wakes up, and this is when he pulls a tooth out of his mouth from his little tussle with Jessica. And he smiles like a psycho in the mirror with a bloody mouth. And, you know, I'm sure it's no big deal, though, because I'm like, he can't just charm a dentist.
I didn't think all that, but
know, he could have that shit fixed in 2 hours. You know, he could just be like, my appointment is next. You're Everyone else needs to in? Leave. You know? Yeah, so, I mean, I'm sure.
I'll get a new tooth.
Yeah, I mean, he fixed his kidneys. You know, he fixed his fucking kidneys. I'm sure a tooth ain't nothing.
Yeah,
from that poor bastard.
I've seen him smile after that scene. The tooth is already back in, you know? They should have had a dentist scene, but I guess we just didn't have the time.
Or the budget. And it's like, guys, we got... Yeah, budget. That's fine, but guys, we got to get to the next episode.
Yeah, exactly. He's not the, you know, Enid from Walking Dead isn't the only person who follows the philosophy of JSS. Anyway, so Jessica gets a call from Kilgrave. This is what you guys were talking about, where he tells her that it's rare for him to feel.
Yeah, where, you know, when he wakes up, it was like, you know, plays that mind game with her.
Yeah, he says that it's rare for him to feel helpless. And I was thinking that it's rare for him to feel unconscious either. She knocked him the fuck out. But yeah, anyway, he talks about how his life is literally in Jessica's hands and that he wants to know why she wanted him alive. And he tells her that Malcolm was an addict waiting to happen. And then Kilgrave says that he'll leave Malcolm alone so long as Jessica takes a smiling picture every morning at 10 in the morning. And then he says, take a picture, save the junkie, which was a Heroes reference. And then this starts one of the coolest aspects of the series, like I mentioned before, because we have a ritual of Jessica taking these uncharacteristic happy pictures for Kilgrave. So in a way, without having control, he has a way to control her from long distance through Malcolm, which now makes her in turn the victim. So really cool psychological stuff going on here. Very clever mind games.
And it ups the creep factor on Kilgrave.
Yeah, definitely. Now he has a collection of Jessica Jones photos and it's on his phone.
Yeah, and that was it.
The obsession. I mean, like, when he gets that first picture sent to him, it's like you just thought he was going to just, like, grab the cold cream and just go at it right then.
Yeah, he was going to be wrestling his bald-headed soldier or whatever it was that that guy said, right?
God damn.
Oh, boy. But yeah, that was the episode. She smiles and takes the picture. It's like bittersweet because it's like, that's such a beautiful way to direct this, because the last shot is Jessica smiling. But when you look at it, the good guy's lost in this episode. That's why she has to take that picture.
Yeah.
You know, so kind of ironic.
Anything she can do to get an advantage.
Yeah, she's basically trapped now in his clutches in a way.
Yeah, exactly. And that brings us to episode 6 called AKA You're a Winner.
No one's really a winner in this show.
No. It opens with Malcolm saying that there was a kind of freedom to being controlled by Kilgrave, free from the burdens of fear and other emotions. And we don't see anything. This is a black screen narrative. We don't know who Malcolm's speaking to yet. And it flashbacks to Kilgrave at a poker game. And he takes
another one of my favorite scenes.
This scene was so perfect.
This was awesome.
It was beautiful.
He makes a guy.
This goes back to what I would do if I had his power.
See, exactly. This is exactly. Yeah, it's like, hey, you, go all in. You know where we're at? Fold your cards.
Yeah, but you know what? It's cool the way he does it, because first he makes the guy put out his cigar and his own drink. He does it casually. He's just like, put him out.
Yes, yes.
And then he makes them go all in. But it's because they could see, like, one of the guys is like, you need to have a better poker face, because I guess the guy's an experienced poker player, so he can tell that Kilgriff has a bad hand. And then he makes them all go in, and he makes the pot. This makes the pot over $1 million. And then that's when he makes everybody fold, and he wins with a 2 and a 7.
Yeah, and there's and I like subtly, like, there's this one guy at the poker table that's like that you know, you see constantly, like, what the fuck am I doing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he tells them that they'll be talking for years about the night that they lost $1 million to the worst hand they'd ever seen. And then as he's leaving, one of the guys demands a chance to win all of the money back. And Kilgriff says for him to see how long it takes him to put his head through that post. And then the guy just starts bashing his head into the post. Yeah. And everybody's trying to stop him. But the funny thing about it is that it fit the scenario well enough that no one's ever going to think anything went wrong. Because what it looks like happened is that a bunch of guys, for some fucking reason, lost their money in a poker game. And then the one dude took it really hard and started bashing his head into the fucking post. And then if the guy says that for some reason he doesn't remember it that way, and that he felt like he was controlled and just compelled to do it, they're going to just tell him that it's part of the trauma of the head shit that happened to him. He just had a rough night. No, you know, so basically it's cool the way all those things, it almost appears like he doesn't exist.
The irony of that scene is, like, that guy was the biggest asshole in that group, and some of the band's like, should we stop him? Should we stop him?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it was like that until the fact they saw he was legit doing it hard to the point that he probably started busting open his forehead.
Yeah, they were like, ah, shit, now we gotta stop him. Even though I was like, ah, I really hate this guy, but I don't want him to die.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, they're gonna have to stop that guy from putting his head through shit for the next 12 hours. You know, he's gonna wake up in the middle of the night and try to drive back to that place to put his head through that specific post.
He's gonna need a doggy cone.
Yeah. So it cuts back to Malcolm.
Put a helmet on his head.
Yeah, right. Give him a helmet.
That too.
Oh boy. So we cut back to Malcolm and Jessica, who are talking about Kilgriff and how to deal with him. And that's who Malcolm was talking to in the beginning in the black screen. It was Malcolm and Jessica having a conversation with Malcolm laying on the couch. And looks like Malcolm's clean at this point. He seems to be over that entire bad part that the junkies go through. And then, you know, the whole cold turkeying thing. And then Luke Cage knocks on the door and he wants to hire Jessica. And Luke tells her about, Antoine Greer, who basically owes a loan shark. But he disappeared a week ago and his sister Serena's worried about him. And Antoine hasn't, made any payments in this time. And Serena's given him the money to pay. And Luke promised that he would get him back to her. And Joan asks if that's his kid, I think, is what she asks. Right? She's like, are they yours or something? And then Luke says, do you really want to know? And then she just winds up taking the case, and she says she's going to take care of it the first thing in the morning. Then we get Holgarth, who calls Jessica to tell her that Hope was attacked in prison. And Jessica comes across Holgarth on the way into the prison. And she tells her that when she went in there, she bribed one of the guards and found out that Sissy Garcia is the one who attacked Hope. And she tells her, your turn. Because she's complaining that this is becoming a very expensive case, having to bribe people and do all of this other shit. And then after that, Jones visits with Sissy, and she strong arms her, and Sissy reveals that Hope paid for the beatdown, $50 and a pack of smokes. So that's pretty rough.
That's the part where I was like, what the fuck? What was the point of that?
Yeah, then, I thought the same thing.
Yeah, and then Jessica visits Hope's room next to find out why she did it, and Hope reveals that she's pregnant with Kilgrave's baby and that she just wanted Sissy to basically punch it out of her, I guess.
And that's when we drop the big R-bomb. Because really, the show's been fine about letting it just creep on the edges, but then it's like, yeah, rape.
Yeah, exactly.
And here's the thing. Jessica Jones is one of the few recent examples to actually use sexual assault of any kind, be it rape or whatever, as a compelling part of the narrative, as something that actually drives it. Unlike many other things of Game of Thrones, that just seemed to use it for shock value or to make you say, oh no, that guy's evil. This actually has an impact on the show in more ways than one.
Ripple
effect. And yeah, exactly. And it matters. Game of Thrones. I'm not going to be subtle about it. That shit pisses me off with that show. But
that's for another show, though. I'm glad you're interested, though, because we can definitely talk about that.
But yeah, but again, this actually uses it very well, and how they go about it is very compelling, thanks to the writing, which is very respectful about it, and the acting that's being done with the performers and that's handling it. And again, that's why I commend this show and why I'm absolutely saying, yeah, this is a show that's important, because again, it's actually handling, you know, this very sensitive, very, you know, very huge topic in a bit of a respectful way. And again, it's not being used as shock value. It's meaning something to the characters and the overall story we're being told.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So next we get to Kilgrave, who's in a diner looking up places on his laptop. Looks like real estate places and stuff. Then he finds a house that catches his attention, and it's funny because he screams, "Everybody quiet!" And then everyone in the diner stops. Not only do they stop talking, but they all look like they feel bad. You know?
Aww. I'm sorry, David. You're still my favorite doctor.
Yeah, and they're all just super, super quiet. And right when he's doing this, the second Jessica selfie comes in. So the game continues. And then
doesn't he say something like, "Cutting it close, Miss Jones," at that point?
Yeah.
So after that, Jones and Cage run into each other, searching for Antoine's apartment. And then Jessica points out that all his hygiene products are missing, so he clearly left willingly. And then they assess that he's a pothead. They wind up calling his cell phone, and someone picks up, and Jessica does this great imitation of like a retailer and saying that he won an Xbox and to come pick up his Xbox. He almost sounds like the secretary from Ghostbusters. Like she has like that kind of
like,
a voice.
"Hello, Antoine, you want a free Xbox One?
We got one."
Yeah.
what I love about that is some of my favorite small little moments. It's like the way Ritter plays it, just how Jessica immediately goes back to scowling mode right after putting on that face like, "Hey, you're a winner." Like, fuck this
yeah.
job.
And her imitations are great because she had to
like
do one of those. Yeah. And she had to do one of those in the first episode, too. Her imitations to get into these places, fantastic. I love when she has
to
play.
Oh, my God. That also just speaks to how good Ritter is as an actress.
Yeah, yeah. And then also in the hospital, that was another good one where she was like, "It's my first day, and the doctor is giving me trouble." And like, she always really goes into the role. It's awesome. It's really awesome. From beginning to end, it's like literally 13 hours of awesome. Jessica's leaving her apartment, and her and Luke run into loan sharks. And Luke makes a deal where Jessica's going to also find this kid. And the two of them ride away on a motorcycle. And he drops her off in her apartment. And Malcolm has a moment to do the big brother thing to Luke, where he's like, "Don't hurt her." Even though Luke can just basically fold Malcolm up and put him in his back pocket, he's cool about it and he doesn't say anything. Then we get Hogarth, who proposes to Pam in the office. But Pam says that first a divorce because she's Catholic, which is a really quick scene leading into Luke, who shows up at Jessica's door to discuss the whole Kilgrave thing. Because apparently during his discussion with Malcolm, Malcolm told him everything. So Luke says that maybe he can make it right. And then she says that he can't because he didn't do anything wrong. And that it was her and she's a piece of shit. And then Luke tells her that she's not a piece of shit. And that leads to them having more sex. Because, you know, that's what the two of them do. So yeah, the following day, Jessica gets a call from the kid's cell phone. And it's a Hispanic sounding guy. And it's the guy, I guess, basically... that wanted the Xbox One, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yes.
And he points out to Luke Cage. He's like, "This guy's not supposed to sound Hispanic, is he?" They give her the address, and then her and Luke go to the place. Before they go, Luke explains that Serena was the administrator at the transit place when he stormed in, demanding answers for his wife's death, and that apparently she's come forward with some proof. But it's an exchange. You know, she wants, he hands over her brother, her missing brother, and she'll hand over the proof. And he also explains that he finds out that his wife buried something in the foundation of this specific address. And when Luke brings that up, it triggers a flashback in Jessica's mind. And it reminds her of a scene where she's digging next to Luke Cage's wife. And she's pulling out a box that's containing apparently whatever Luke is looking for.
Yeah. Containing a USB drive.
Yeah.
Which is yellow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yellow USB drive. Don't see much of those.
At the end of the conversation, Jessica has to take another smiling pic. So we get Jessica bringing Hope the abortion pill. With no hesitation, Hope swallows it. And then after that, we get Kilgrave, who's trying to persuade a man to buy his house. And he shows him a briefcase full of money, which is $1.26 million. And the guy's like, you could buy two houses with this. But Kilgrave wants this house. And he shows him all the paperwork and tells him to be gone by tomorrow. I found it intriguing that Kilgrave didn't just force this guy out of the house. He decided to legit use the money that he illegitimately got from the poker
right,
game to
buy the house. Right, because he was like, oh, this is so hard, not trying to control you.
Yeah, you know, I guess he just wanted to try and see what it was like to have to not get his way. You know, just him going through his own little journey there.
Yeah.
And money talks.
Yeah, exactly. So Jessica and Luke are trailing that Hispanic Xbox One guy, and they find out that he's at what looks like a warehouse. And then we get another one of those famous Jessica Jones pulling off of a lock scenes, and they break into a greenhouse full of pot. And that's when we get Sweet Christmas.
Sweet Christmas.
Which is really appropriate for a house full of green, huh?
Yeah.
I see what you did there. I see what you did there.
Yeah, the one time Sweet Christmas couldn't be more appropriate.
Right. So a couple of dogs attack Luke, and he's busy with them, and Jones finds the Hispanic guy and busts through a door to where the kid Antoine is, and it turns out that he was growing all of this weed to pay back the loan sharks, and then the loan sharks show up in numbers with all of their guards and stuff, and they want to take him, and Jones tries to persuade them not to, but it doesn't work, which leads to Luke Cage and Jessica Jones having a big fight scene where they're beating up all the guys and knocking weed over everywhere, and Jessica takes the kid and leaves Luke to fight the rest of the guys on his own. And Luke kind of gives her this look like, you're fucking leaving me. And she gives him this look like, yeah, dude, I'm leaving you. You know, which was kind of fucked up. But, you know, she just sort of had to do it. But Jessica brings him back to Serena, and Jessica demands the proof. And then Luke comes in right behind her. And Luke takes the folder. And then Jessica clearly doesn't want him to see what's in it. She's making all type of excuses. She's like, you don't need to see that. Don't worry about what's in it. It's all bullshit, you know, like she doesn't want him to see this. So then Luke finds out that the bus driver is Charles Wallace, who was drunk on the job and basically killed his wife, which is really shitty. By the way, Charles Wallace is an anchor for Marvel. So that's another little Easter egg in there that they decided to throw for you comic book people.
Hooray.
I did not know that. That's a cool little tidbit.
And yes, the moment that whole reveal is,
yeah,
it's one of the most powerful moments in this entire show because it changes so much so many dynamics in a single motion, and it's also a great chance for even Mike Coulter to do a little more as Luke Cage and just really get that rage out.
Yeah, he's not being a badass, but he's just being he's like distraught. It's a different sort of rage coming from him at this point. Jessica tells him that it's over now that he knows, and Luke nods and walks away. But then after he leaves, Serena tells Jessica that Luke's gonna go kill Charles Wallace because his blood alcohol levels never made it to the report because his brother was one of the higher ups in the transit authority and he covered the whole thing, and he still drives the exact same bus route, and Luke knows it. So now Jessica's like, oh shit, Luke's gonna go fucking kill this guy. And Luke is in the back of the bus, and Luke comes to the front, and he reveals that he's the husband of the person that Charles killed, and then Charles says that he's been sober ever since the accident, and he's just trying to make things right. And then Luke throws him through the front of the bus glass, and Jessica shows up and urges him to run. And then she confesses that she's the one that killed Luke's wife, and she confesses that she's the one who dug up the hidden item, and that she punched Luke's wife full force, and that she was dead before the bus even got there. And then Luke freaks out at the fact that Jessica slept with him and that made him think that he could get past it. And then he asked, did Kilgrave make you do that? And then he says one of the more awkward lines. He says, you let me be inside you.
And,
I was like, okay, guys.
And that is an awkward, let me tell you, that is a very, very, very awkward line to hear. You know, just
it's
especially
a very descriptive line.
It's the equivalent of when Lana and Rusev were on Raw last week, and they were like, I didn't go all the way.
Yeah, but imagine that if he would have went like, you let me go all the way with you. They wanted to make this be more intimate, so they made it a little too intimate because he's all like, you let me be inside of you. And when you say, even though it's Luke Cage, who's a masculine guy, well, hearing that from anyone, like you could hear that.
I guess he couldn't have been like, you let me fuck you.
You could hear that from fucking Solid Snake. Like, listen to this, guys. You could hear that from Solid Snake himself. You know what I mean?
Oh, shit.
I want you inside me.
You know?
What the?
Like, even from the master David Hayter himself, Solid Snake. Like, think about how awkward that is. Like, listen to that for a minute.
I want you inside me.
Okay. No, okay. First off.
That sounds like he was reading the script live and he's like, I want you. What? Like this inside me?
Okay. First off, let's be honest. That was always going to be awkward from David Hayter because not exactly the best voice actor. Come at me, fucking everybody.
I disagree. David Hayter's awesome. They shouldn't have had to put Sutherland in that role. Just because he's good in 24 doesn't make him Snake.
I've met him twice. He's a fucking asshole.
Okay. Again, I've already made an enemy about quarter of the internet. Anyway, by the way, just for reference, never play a single Metal Gear game. I just know I was like, he's not exactly the best voice actor. All right, I've already dug my grave. Anyway, yeah. It's a stupidly awkward one, and that was one of the most like, okay, guys, this episode has a great example of great and not so great writing. The great writing I mentioned earlier with how the show actually handled the topic of rape.
Yeah.
And so it's like, that's amazing. That's great. And this is like, guys, like,
damn it.
The fuck, guys, what happened?
Yeah. And then
Were you feeling off by the end of the day? It's like, yo, we got red t-shirt.
Yep. And then the basically what breaks the camel's back is the fact that Luke asked Jessica if he wouldn't have found out what she have told him, and she just doesn't answer. So then Luke says that he was wrong and that she is a piece of shit and walks away.
No, yeah, and again, the moment's incredible. It's a fascinating moment to see how much that she Mike Coulter just changed on a dime.
Because he's in love.
Yeah, they both started to be like, man, I can move on from my wife now. Everything's going good. What the fuck?
Yeah, he's like, man, I really love this woman, man. I really love her a lot, you know?
I want you. Inside me.
God damn it, stop.
Doesn't get old.
Jesus.
Oh, yeah, but that we're keeping that one.
Oh, God.
But anyway.
But no, it's a great moment that really shows the dynamic of this. And again, since it's not a halfway point, it also makes for a great, marking point. Since, again, halfway point, it definitely changes things of where we've had them so far.
Now,
and really shows like it ain't ever gonna be the same now.
You got to give them credit for being restrained because they could have just had the scene devolve into just beating the crap out of each other like a normal superheroes do.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, no, it was a very tense, very nicely written and well performed scene.
And I think Jessica would have gotten ahead. Caved in if he did fight Luke Cage. I don't think she's as strong as he is, so it wouldn't have been pretty.
It got ugly real quick.
So after this, we cut to Malcolm and the Kilgrave support group briefly. It just shows that they're progressing. There's really no character development here. And then we cut back to Hogarth and Hope. And she's basically talking to a nurse because Hogarth wants the dead fetus. And Jessica is sitting on the ground reciting her old address of Birch Street and Higgins Drive. And then Kilgrave has the house now, which we discover as the camera pans out is Jessica's old family home on Birch Street and Higgins. Exactly. It's on Birch Street and Higgins asshole drive.
Now,
unbelievable.
God damn.
At first, I thought that this was a guy that Kilgrave couldn't affect because he was like, yeah, I want to buy the house. He's like, I don't want to sell it. And he just kept saying he didn't want to sell it. And I thought the only reason why he changed his mind was there was just too much money. But then later, he was like, yeah, you got to be out by a certain time. I guess his powers hadn't gotten back to full strength because it seemed inconsistent, like whether or not he could actually tell this guy what to do or not.
No, I looked at it more of like pretty much what he tells the guy. It's more of he wanted to see if he could just take the house legitimately by giving him the money. And in the end of it all, it was just like, I gave you the money and you still didn't want to take it. But just fuck it. Get out the house.
He gave him the money because, you know, they.
He had no use for that money, no, anyway, so he could have been like, "Here, take the money."
Because people love money.
He wanted to buy the house legally because he could have just said, "Give me your house," and walk away. But he wanted to make sure that he legally owned the house, and there was nothing that could have the house. The house couldn't be taken from him later. That was the reason.
He didn't want to leave a trace. He was just like,
Then you got to factor in, he gives the guy the money. Yeah, the guy signs the stuff. What happens when the hours are up and the guy comes back?
He could have kept the guy around as his personal slave, though. Like
it's a nice little bounce. Like, hey, he uses his power to get the money, but it's just like, what gets him the house? Good old bribery.
Yeah, but he could have kept that guy. He could have kept that guy there as a slave. He did it with those other people before, and just had the guy work for him in the house and never leave or something. I guess then he has to worry in the long term about if the guy doesn't show up at his job or if other family members come. He clearly wanted this to be perfect, so you're probably right in the sense where it's like he wanted to legit own this house, so he did.
And see, that's what makes Kilgrave an effective villain. He's incredibly smart like that.
But like Hogarth said about him, imagine how much better he would be if he was like on their side or just using his powers in a more clever way, or even as a villain on a grand scale, you know?
Yeah. Again, I find this is a very solid block of episodes, but this last episode is where things really started to pick up.
Yeah, it's gonna be fun from this point out. So that was it. We did 4 through 6, and before we get out of here, do you guys have any last thoughts and reflection of this arc of the story?
Halfway through, and it's a hell of an incredible story with some, it's not very mythology heavy, but it's intriguing certainly, because that at 6th episode really leaves you on a great little cliffhanger of the family. Like, what's Kilgrave up to and such? And how is the dynamic going to change further? What's Luke going to be up to next? It's very fascinating how it builds us up to this halfway point and where it leaves us. And I imagine this would be just as equally effective if it were a regular weekly broadcast show as well, because it has that certain hook that keeps you guessing, and it's fantastic. And more of David Tennant now being fully in the game is great, because he's amazing. And again, I commend this show for actually taking on a very serious subject within our culture that's been more prominently, and actually doing it in a very respectful way.
Absolutely.
Props to the writers on this show.
Well said. And Jen, what about you? What are your last thoughts here?
It only gets better.
Yeah, it really does. It really does only get better. What was your favorite, what you say, out of these 3 episodes, 4, 5, and 6?
I liked all 3, to be honest. It's really hard to pick a favorite out of those 3.
Yeah, and besides,
I'll say episode 6 stood out to me.
Okay, fair enough.
I feel sorry for poor Luke Cage. to find out that he's been up to his wife's killer.
That is kind of fucked up. It really is.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to give Luke a hug.
You know, it's weird because I kind of was more on the Jessica side, where being that he understands what Kilgrave is, I expected him to understand a little bit more, you know, like she was completely mind controlled.
I mean, he understands, but it still doesn't change the fact that it's like, I just slept with the chick that killed my wife.
You see, it's convenient, though, to say that she's not in control when it doesn't directly affect him. And I do understand his grief and everything, but it wasn't her fault.
It wasn't my fault.
She never confessed up front as to what happened between him and his wife.
And then even when he asked her, like, would you have told me, she still doesn't answer that.
Yeah.
Because she's a piece of shit.
Yeah, that's messed
up. Oh, Jessica.
I mean, when you find that out, man, it's just no way you can have a sweet Christmas.
Wow, right? Totally.
God damn it.
That's line of the night right there.
Oh, I'm just shaking my goddamn head right now.
You know, sometimes Christmas can be very sweet. Just saying.
Indeed. No, it is. I'm hoping for a sweet Christmas this year.
Anyway, overall, it was good. It's been great being with you guys here talking about this. These are becoming more and more fun as we get further into the series. Jen, good to have you on for the first time. Hope you had fun.
Oh, I had a blast.
Mick, great having you here as always.
Yeah, I feel so depressed now that you're playing the closing music, because I mentioned to you I changed my music on my phone to the Jessica Jones intro.
Yeah,
nobody calls me, so I never get to hear it.
Aww.
Yeah,
Surfer and Jordan, what are you reading? Comic book show. Don't forget to tune into them. Support all of the shows. TalkBrunch.com, RantEMRadio.com. Just come check us all out. Follow us on Twitter. All of the links are all there. Just look them up. We're easy to find. We're always around. And yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. See you guys for the next episode. On that note, we're out of here.
See ya.
Hey. Good night.